May it please the court. Thornton Percival representing the appellant Kevin Kanyer on the matter of the estate of Mary Ellen Kanyer. We're asking the court, my client Kevin Kanyer is asking the court to reverse this matter back for trial based on what we think is an injustice as far as his first right of refusal rights under the trust. It's a little bit unusual. Mr. Kanyer and Mrs. Kanyer both set up a trust in 2000. 4 months thereafter, Mr. Kanyer passed away. Under the terms of the trust, there is both a marital trust, a family trust, and a survivor's trust, basically three sub-trusts. The marital trust is not before the court. It comes down to the issue of the family trust. And under the terms of the trust, under the family trust provision, paragraph 11.4.1 says that Kevin Kanyer, the appellant, is given a right of first refusal in the Indianola property, which shall be personal to our son. The Indianola property, of course, is on the other side of Puget Sound, and Mrs. Kanyer has a condo on Alki Point. What she did, apparently, was make a switch somewhere after her husband died.
Doesn't the trust provisions allow for that? Said make a switch.
Okay. It does allow to the extent of one half of the community property or separate property. And she cannot change the trust, which is like a normal contract that she made with her husband for his one half of the community property or separate property. So our position is that her actions are limited to the community property, as the court determined at the lower level. It is all community property. Originally, the respondent filed a TEDRA action against my client. Now, we'll never know the reason why it was done, but she was claiming that the Indianola property was separate property. At that point in time, we proved to the lower court as part of partial summary judgment motion, that in fact it was all community property by way of a community property agreement. Therefore, we have no separate property involved here. It's just a question of what goes into the family trust and what goes into the survivor's trust. And the contract with the decedent, Mr. Kanyer, was that Indianola would be a property available for the first right of refusal. And for reasons unknown, she decided to put the condo into the family trust and the Indianola property into the survivor's trust. But we never got to the point maybe to answer your question, Your Honor, we never saw the total assets to the estate. It's true that Mrs. Kanyer, and I conceded at the trial court level, Mrs. Kanyer could spend all the money because it was for her benefit initially. However, in terms of the family trust is concerned, there is a specific right given to Mr. Kevin Kanyer, the appellant, to the Indianola property, and she maybe should have offered that to him first before she made the transition.
Which provision are you relying on for that assertion?
I'm relying on paragraph 11.1.
Doesn't the trust agreement allow her to fund the family trust with any property, with cash, with a combination, in kind? And it was the condominium that ultimately was placed into the family trust, wasn't it?
Only as to her half of the community property. Once Mr. Kanyer died, it became irrevocable, and you can't change it. That's what makes it so interesting. So you have to basically trace the property that belonged to each party to determine what part of the property can be changed versus the remaining property.
Didn't the trial court say, well, even accepting that argument, it doesn't matter because it's clear from the trust document that she's entitled to all of the income. She's a trust beneficiary for both her trusts.
She is entitled to if you look at the language for the family trust, the income of the family trust was for the benefit of the surviving spouse. Here she basically took income producing property and put it into the survivor's trust. and it should have stayed in the family trust or been first offered to Mr. Kenyer before it was exchanged. The values are based upon what the values were at the time of Mr. Kenyer's death, Eddie Kenyer's death. And those values, I think, are accurate for that period of time. I don't contest it. I'm just saying that you can't take away the rights of a first right of refusal rights, since the contract with her late husband gave him that right so long as it was there. But here she voluntarily makes the change. It's like amending the agreement with her husband, who is no longer around. She can amend it to the extent under paragraph 18.1 that it is not inconsistent with express provisions of the trust. And it's paragraph 18.1. And to me, my understanding of an express provision under the terms of this trust is that there's an express right of a first right of refusal for the family trust running to Kevin Kenyer. Now, we don't know. I realize, I think the Judge Andrus was, she understands that there are certain rights of withdrawal and revocation. But the problem in terms of her conclusion was, she said, well, if you go out and spend all the money, what are my client's rights? And we don't argue that point. But the point we do argue is that if there's a need, we need to know all the assets of the estate in terms of cash, bank accounts, property, total them all up and figure out what portion goes into the family trust and what portion goes into the survivor's trust, because she can't amend the agreement with her husband because that part became irrevocable upon his death.
Do you agree that under the trust she had the right to sell his half interest in the property? Isn't that what she did here?
She actually sold and gifted.
And you're saying she had no right under the trust agreement?
She had to first offer it to my client, Kevin Kenyer, the appellant. And if he chose not to do it, then she has that right to sell. But the contract was with her husband that he would have a first right of refusal. So in terms of remanding the case, because I think it's a material issue of fact upon which the outcome of litigation depends as to whether or not what is all the property that belongs to the estate, what half of it was contributed by the husband, and what half she contributed, but she can't amend the half that Mr. Kenyer left for his son in terms of a first right of refusal. And that remainderment interest is something that basically preempts her rights to sell. She's just at first had to offer it to Mr. Kenyer. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm out of time.
Good morning. May it please the court. Howard Goodfriend representing the respondent, Mary Ellen Kenyer. The trust did not require that any specific assets be placed in any specific subtrust. It required that the value of assets be applied to either the survivorship trust or the family trust. Specifically, Article 9.2 refers to the value, and it refers to the value of the decedent's one-half interest in the community property. And we can see that everything before the court was community property. The appellant relies upon one particular provision of this inter vivos trust, Article 11.42, in derogation of the numerous other specific provisions that authorized Mary Ellen to do exactly as she did. Article 11.4.2 could not obligate Mary Ellen to hold the Indianola property in trust for the benefit of Kevin in derogation of the other clear provisions of the instrument. This right of contract is, I think, a fallacy. Kevin had no enforceable right of first refusal to the Indianola property specifically. What he had was an expectancy, and he had an expectancy that Mary Ellen was free to amend, to revoke entirely, at least as to her one-half interest of the community property. Article 4.3 of the trust and Article 4.1 of the trust are clear as to that. And I think as to his father's one, so Mary Ellen clearly had the right to gift her one-half interest of the community property. That was clear. As to his father's one-half interest, which I think is the basis for his argument that there's an enforceable contract here, he was a remainderman. He was a remainderman of the family trust because Mary Ellen could, in her absolute discretion, fund the trust with specific property or with cash, because, recall, it speaks of the value. Article 9.2.3 is clear as to that. It gives her the absolute discretion to fund it with specific property or its value. And she had the absolute discretion, as the lifetime beneficiary of the trust, to spend that cash on her support and maintenance in her sole discretion. Article 11.1, 11.2, and Article 18.1 are also clear as to that. And the trustee's duties are determined first and foremost by looking at what the trust instrument provides. And the trust instrument gave her the discretion to support herself with the income, and there, as Judge Andrus found in her very well-reasoned decision, no argument that discretion was being exercised improperly. In fact, Kevin below at the argument, and it's in the verbatim report of proceedings, I think on page 37, conceded as much. She could use that income for any way she wanted. She could go on a cruise if she wanted to. There was no issue of fact for a trial here, first because it's undisputable. Given the evidence below, Mary Ellen's accountant and her tax lawyer both testified by declaration without rebuttal that it was entirely prudent for Mary Ellen to hold on to the condominium and the survivorship trust because it would appreciate more than the recreational Indianola Capite. It would provide her for a place to live, and it would allow her to generate income for her maintenance and support. And what Judge Andrus found, I think, was, she funded the family trust with the Alki condo and placed the Indianola cabin in the survivor trust. What she found, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Those were her exact words, because of the fact that she had the right to place her one-half interest in the survivorship trust and gift it to Jeffrey and use Eddie's half for her support and maintenance during her lifetime. As to the values were established and they were uncontroverted. The amount of assets available to her at the time of her husband's death were before the court. The condo was worth $260,000. The Indianola property was worth slightly more, $273,000. There was also a brokerage account in the amount of $158,000. And Mary Ellen's testimony in her verified motion before the court was that her liquid assets were dwindling. She decided to sell Eddie's one-half interest in the cabin to her son for fair market value, also undisputed. No sweetheart deal, fair market value, less the amount of that she would have paid for a commission. So what was left for trial, given the discretion vested in Mary Ellen under the terms of the trust, given the undisputed testimony regarding the values and the assets that were available, and given her undisputed ability to use both principal and income out of her late husband's estate for her support and maintenance?
Well, how do we not simply disregard the obligation to accord a right of first refusal if we don't say that that's at the point that the determination was made to sell the one-half interest, that the other son should have been given the right of first refusal as to that one-half interest?
Well,
in other words, otherwise we're writing it right out of the document.
You're not writing it right out of the document, because I think what it's saying is it's not a present right. It's clear that it's upon her death, A. B, it's also clear that it's subject to the distributions above. That's the way it's framed. If you look at Article 11, point 2, no, I'm sorry, 11.3, the immediately preceding section says, after our death and after payment and distributions authorized in the preceding articles, the remaining assets shall be part of the family trust.
And that's a document signed both by husband and wife.
That's the original trust document. So you're not writing it out of the trust, but what you are saying is that it is subject to A, her right to make withdrawals of principal during her lifetime, and that's the principal asset, and B, it's subject to you know, whatever is left over if it's there upon her death. It doesn't have to be. And I think the structure of the trust and reading all the sections in harmony makes it pretty clear that it was contingent upon the asset still being there based upon her discretionary funding for her needs and her liquidity. And
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Didn't the son in his declaration also testify that I've never asserted that the Indianola property cannot be sold, and here it was sold. The family trust, much like the survivor trust, is for Mary Ellen's income and needs after death. So, and he, didn't he also concede that his interest was a, as a remainderman interest?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any dispute that it's a remainderman interest. And keep in mind that, you know, what the argument that they're making would be to override Mary Ellen's discretion to do as she pleases with her one-half interest in community property.
At best, their argument is to one-half of the community
Exactly, exactly. And it's, and given the structure of the trust and its references to value in terms of funding the trust, it's pretty clear that there was no obligation by Mary Ellen at the time of her husband's death to fund any specific trust with any specific asset. The trust is absolutely clear on that. If there are no further questions, we ask the court to affirm and to award us Mary Ellen her fees under the TEDRA statute. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
My response to the decision of Judge Andrus is that she was claiming that there was an account that was dwindling, and that was one of the reasons why she ought to make a change in the property. And the bottom line is, I think the record will show that she gifted $300,000 to the son who now owns Indianola. That doesn't sound like someone who's in a desperate condition. That house was sold to her son, and the record will show that she gifted $300,000 of that purchase price.
Didn't they offer a lot of help and assistance to her? So it wasn't just merely a gift. They helped her with the construction of the new home.
Yes, and my client, and the reason why that clause is in there, I think there's a strong inference, there's a reason why it's, that first right of refusal was given to him. The record will show that, in fact, Kevin Canyer did substantial improvements to that cabin, but unfortunately it burned down. But Mr. Canyer felt very strongly about that property because he'd been in there for years. In fact, had lived there almost rent-free because that cabin needed to be maintained. Unfortunately, it caught fire. So who provides the most value and is entitled to it, I think, is questionable, and the lower court should consider that as well. It was at least 6+ years that Mr. Kevin Canyer lived there. As far as...
But you raised that issue for the first time in your reply brief, though, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. I agree. I think we'll find that it's not just a contract. It's a while he has a remainderment interest, he has a right to at least be offered the property before the change was made to give it to the son or sell it to the son. And that's the whole purpose. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both. That concludes this morning's calendar. The court will stand at recess.
All rise.